Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Richmond, Virginia, got a bachelor's degree from Duke University, and an MBA from Harvard. He joined General Motors in 1977, rose through its ranks, and became its president and CEO in 2000. He arguably got America back on its feet after 9/11 by implementing Keep America Rolling, the 0% financing plan. Today, he's General Motors' chairman and CEO. His name, Rick Wagoner. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible, presented by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR. Brought to you by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Now, here's Jack.
We're with the chairman and CEO of General Motors, Rick Wagoner. Rick, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
Thanks, Jack. Great to be with you tonight.
Can you start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
Sure. Was born in Wilmington, Delaware. We moved around a little bit and ended up in Richmond, Virginia when I was about six. And so I sort of consider that my child home. In fact, my mom and I have a sister who still live there. And I had what I think I could categorize as a very middle-class upbringing. My dad was an accountant for Eskimo Pie, which had some benefits for us at home. Not quite like being at a car company, but that was pretty good for a kid. And then my mom stayed at home and raised my two sisters and myself. And I would say it was about as normal as you could imagine. You know, public school, fascinated with sports, like you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd say very, very fun and not particularly stressful.
What were the biggest things that you learned from your mom and your dad?
Well, they both always had very high expectations of us, and particularly in the sense that we should do our best. And I think... they were, at the same time, always supporting us in whatever we did. So they were willing to get in the car and drive us to whatever sports practice or play practice or school activity. But they did expect when we were there, we would do the best job we could. They instilled a good work ethic, I think, in my sisters and myself. I always had a job, it seemed like, when I was a kid. They knew how to laugh and have fun as well. So I think it was a great family upbringing and certainly set the tone for my expectations for my own family life.
When you were a kid, what did you think you would become?
I thought I was going to play in the NBA, Jack.
So.
Yeah, I started, when I was a kid, I really loved sports. So I went from, you know, football and baseball and basketball, which is pretty much what everybody played back then. And I was always serious about my studies and was expected to do well and did. But certainly, I thought I'd go to college and be a star, this athlete or that athlete, hadn't picked out the sport probably at the time. And then for sure, I'd go play in the NBA like my then hero, Jerry West. But as I got a little older, I realized probably I'm lucky that I did a little studying, too.
Can you share with us your days at Duke University?
Yeah, I had a great time at Duke. Have a good friend who said the problem with college is it's too bad you can't go through backwards. Because when you first get to college, you're kind of anxious about being away from home and missing your family and friends. And by the time you leave, you love college so much you don't want to leave. So I always thought that was an interesting perspective. But had a good experience there. Obviously, going from a public school in Richmond to a place like Duke, you say, hey, am I going to be able to perform at the academic level that I would hope? But I got there and studied hard and did well academically and had a good time, played freshman basketball there. And it was a great experience, had a few good games, and also realized that my dream of the NBA probably wasn't a realistic one. But it was a good experience.
It's 1977. You get out of school. And you're hired by this company, General Motors. How did that come about?
Well, I was finishing up with my MBA from Harvard. After I graduated from Duke, I went up there to get an MBA. And it was a good time for the economy back then. And so I had an opportunity to interview with a lot of different companies from really kind of every field that you could imagine. I was sort of thinking at the time I'd really like to work sort of anywhere in the U.S., but not in New York City. And so I ended up interviewing with GM in their office in New York City and going to work there because I was impressed with, obviously, the company, but the energy in the workplace. And I felt like this is a place that is a real meritocracy. You go and you do your best, and if you work hard, you get a chance to move ahead. And actually, turns out that was a good read on the experience that I would ultimately have here at GM.
You've held many, many positions at GM. Can you talk about some of those key jobs?
Yeah, I had a great number of chances that we've really enjoyed. I think maybe most significant, you know, we started out in New York, as I mentioned, and we're there about 4.5 years and got the opportunity to move to be treasurer of GM do Brazil fairly early in my career. And it was a great experience for my wife, Kathy, and I. We didn't have kids at the time, and we moved down and had a chance to learn the country and learn the language. And business-wise, I got a chance to really get my hands on all parts of the business, not just my treasury job, which was my day job, but I got a chance to go to the plant, to meet with dealers, and I learned so much. And then we had I had a promotion there to be head of finance, which was, again, a great experience. And from there, we moved to Canada, where we were for a couple years, loved that. And then after a very brief stop in Detroit, I went to Zurich for a couple of years, where, again, we had a terrific experience. And through these moves, by the way, we accumulated our three sons, two born the first time in Brazil and one in Switzerland. And then after that, I moved back to Brazil as managing director, which may have been the most fun job I had in my career. And then in the end of 92, came to Detroit as CFO of GM and have been here ever since. So a lot of moves early in the career, a lot internationally, and great chance to learn about different cultures and about our business in different ways. So I think that's maybe the most valuable part of my career, actually.
Rick Wagner, it's 2000. Let's jump to 2000. You're named president and CEO of GM. How did you find out about that? And what did you do that night?
Well, my boss, Jack Smith, great guy, still a great friend, called me into his office and he said, Rick, I've been talking to the board and we're going to make you president and CEO. I said, well, that's great news. A little bit of a surprise, to be honest. And Jack, believe it or not, I can't remember exactly what I did, but I'm sure I went home and told my wife and sons. I'll probably told them they were not going to get an increase in their allowance, too. I would imagine that they might have been thinking about that. And we may have celebrated with a glass of wine, but if it was a work night, I suspect that I went back and then opened my briefcase and got to the task at hand.
We're talking to Rick Wagner, and the rumor on the street is that he's really gone green. The rumor is that he's becoming a vegan. When we come back, we'll ask him about that. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Brought to you by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Once again, here's your host, Jack Crisula.
Welcome back. We're with Rick Wagner. Rick, I've got inside information that Kathy's been feeding you raw oatmeal with flaxseed and bananas for breakfast. True?
True, Jack. Yeah, that's how I keep my boyish figure.
So,
I'm advised that this is going to pay big dividends later on in life. Obviously, it's quite an upfront investment, but I have to say I feel better in the morning when I eat stuff like that.
So, you've said that you're not the smartest person at GM. What did you mean by that? And a second question, what do you do all day? What's your basic job as chairman and CEO of General Motors?
Yeah, what I mean by that, Jack, is a lot of leadership is not about just knowing the answers and knowing how everything works. Because as you get up to higher levels in larger companies, as you know, you really have to make sure you have the best people and empower them to work and make sure they're working well together. So when I go to the R&D labs and talk to some of our scientists there, it's pretty clear to me that those guys were getting the 1600 on their SATs or whatever, which I can assure you wasn't my score. So we're lucky at GM to have a lot of smart people and a lot of smart people in different fields. And if we are successful, and this is, I think, the key job of any leader, getting everyone to work together, leveraging their expertise, and then working closely with others who have other neighboring expertises, put all that together, then we can have a great business. And that's really what leadership is all about.
How did you, your team, Ron Gettelfinger, and his team at the UAW achieve this transformational agreement recently?
This was a lot of hard work, Jack. I mean, you're right. It was a, I think you're correct in saying it was a transformational agreement. And the way it started was we had very honest conversations back and forth with the UAW leadership under Ron's direction to talk about the challenges that we faced as a company, as an industry. What were the issues that he felt were of importance from the union and its constituents' perspective? And we didn't prescribe necessarily specific solutions. We have to do it this way. We just said, gee, we need this kind of outcome. Let's talk about different ways we might accomplish that kind of outcome. And I think through a traditional back-and-forth bargaining process, and I think, frankly, I give Ron a lot of credit for visionary leadership to see that we need to change the game so we can both improve the future prospects for our industry and our companies, but also the people that work there. So it was a great example, I think, of maybe collective bargaining at its best.
In preparing for this show tonight, I read a lot of articles from Fortune, Business Week, Time, Bloomberg in 2003, 4, 5, 6, 7. GM was terminal. Article after article, you're dead, no hope. The issues are overwhelming. How did you survive all of those articles? And systematically, you've attacked one by one and made great strides. How have you done that?
I think an important leadership lesson that I learned through this, Jack, is you got to have a clear vision as to where you want to go. You got to be realistic about the risks and the problems and challenges that you face. And then you've got to go kind of every day chop your wood. Go at each issue, figure out the best solution. Get your best people working on it with the appropriate constituents, and then just get it attacking the problems every day. So I think vision is important, clarity of the challenge, persistence in getting after it, and making sure as you go through that you don't lose sight of the assets you have too. And at GM, you know, we've got some terrifically talented people. We've got some great businesses around the world. And so we tried to make sure that we emphasized the positive opportunities we had, as well as fixing the problems and challenges. And I think, you know, we got to a good balance of that. We frankly still got some more work to do. But great example, I think, of teamwork and of persistence and of sticking with what we knew was right.
Every time I hear three letters in the last year, CTS, the Cadillac CTS, people go crazy. It's a phenomenal success. Everybody that's either driven that car, been in that car, they love that car. Greatest car I've ever seen. Greatest car I've ever owned. How did that happen, Rick? And why can't we do that every time? Whatever the formula is, why can't we do it every time?
Yeah, Jack, you're right. We need to try to do that every time. CTS, as you recall, we did the first generation CTS, and we challenged our team to do a breakthrough product with a very innovative design. I think they did a good job. But then the next round, we said, well, let's take it even better. Okay, what can we do to improve this car? Let's take off all the constraints, make the best car in the category that we can from a handling perspective, from a design perspective, and particularly from the interior. And so I would say we challenged the team to do that, to do the best car in the category. We took off the constraints, and we got the right people on the teams, and they did the job. And I think we can do that again and again. The Chevy Malibu, as we were talking about earlier, did get the same kind of treatment, the same kind of objectives, and they've executed a great car. So part of it is you need to have great people. You need to work in the right process, but you need to set high goals and really support teams in achieving those high goals.
Coach K at Duke, he can watch a sophomore in high school and tell you this is a winner. When do you figure out whether a new introduction is a winner?
You usually have a pretty good sense early on. Now, sometimes market circumstances change or make it a little harder to see. But I would say very early on when you are developing a product even, you have a gut feel as to whether you're going to hit the sweet spot of the market, whether the combination of styling and performance and handling and all that is going to be what the doctor ordered. We've had surprises from time to time where you know, for example, I've made calls that haven't been right, but it's a gut feel that comes, I think, very early in the product development process as to whether these different areas are coming together in an optimal fashion.
Talking about design, styling, let's talk about Bob Lutz. How did you get him? How did you convince him to come? And what has he meant to General Motors.
You know, Bob's been a terrific addition to the company and a fun guy to work with, too, by the way. Every day I enjoy and I learn from him. Several years ago, our head of product development was retiring, and I went out to see Bob at his office in Ann Arbor back then. He had retired from Chrysler and was working at Exide. And I said, hey, Bob, what I want to talk to you about is who is the industry's next Bob Lutz? I want the best possible guy leading our product development. And so Bob and I went through a long list of names and concluded that maybe there wasn't sort of a next Bob Lutz quite ready yet. And I said to him, I said, hey, Bob, you wouldn't be interested in this job. And I'll never forget, he's walking across the room. He turns around and looks at me. He says, don't assume that. And so we worked very quickly from that, and really privileged to have him join us. And, you know, from the first day, it's as I said, been a lot of fun, and give Bob a lot of credit for setting a vision, for executing really excellent products, recognize the importance of design, and played a big role in, you know, the turnaround that we've seen so far, and makes me very excited about the future, too.
Recently, Washington has changed your future dramatically. Can you talk about hybrids and alternative energy?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting time for our industry, Jack. We've been pretty much completely 95, 98% reliant on petroleum as their source of power for most of the last 70, 80 years in the auto industry globally. And we're entering an era where that's going to change for a couple of reasons. The amount of petroleum, more and more people are demanding it, so the price is going up. The availability of it, while it seems very good today, isn't going to last forever. And some of the technologies that we've been trying to develop for years are becoming more technologically and economically feasible. Things like hybrid systems, things like battery systems, alternative fuels like ethanol, and maybe fuel cells. So we're spending a lot of money and, more importantly, technical resources to really try to get out ahead of that parade. And I think the next 20 years in the auto industry are going to be very interesting as we see the propulsion systems change from what we've been used to for most of our lives.
Rick Wagner, what do the great leaders have in common?
Well, I think great leaders, first and foremost, have a vision of what they want to accomplish. It may not be completely clear when they start, but I think fairly early on, it crystallizes in their mind where the organization, where the company, where the government, whatever needs to go. Second of all, they have the ability to transmit that vision to talented people and to work with that group as a team to drive to the single vision. I think great leaders have persistence. They're willing to listen to new ideas for sure, but they really stick at it every day because, as you know, things don't always work out exactly like you want every day. And I find sometimes people get discouraged and want to wander off and try something different. And I think the people that are really most successful really stay with things even when it's a little tough. And if you do that, you can surmount those difficulties and I think come out ahead.
When we come back, we'll ask Rick Wagner about Tiger Woods and the association with Buick and General Motors. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Presented by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Now, here's your host, Jack Crisula.
We're talking to the chairman and CEO of General Motors, Rick Wagner. Rick, can you share with us a couple stories about this kid named Tiger Woods?
Yeah, Tiger's a great guy. I think anybody who's had the privilege of meeting him knows that not only is he a great athlete, but he's a fun person to be around. I think my favorite Tiger story occurred about the time he was getting married, although it wasn't public at the time. And he called into the office. I wasn't there that day and apparently said, can I speak to Rick? This is Tiger. My very capable assistant said, Tiger who? He clarified who he was, and she got the message to me, so we called him back, and it turns out that he said, hey, Rick, it's not public knowledge, but I'm getting married. I said, well, congratulations, that's great. I wasn't sure why he was calling me. Just tell me he's getting married. I could have read that in the newspaper. Turns out he was the week after the wedding scheduled to host a Buick golf tournament outing, and he said, any chance we could change that because my wife would like to go on a honeymoon? I said, Tiger, I can fully understand your wife's perspective, and we were able to work it out. But it showed me the guy is, I mean, he's a great human being in addition to being a great golfer.
What makes him so special?
I think a couple of things. I think first, he obviously has tremendous God-given skills. But I've heard him speak once, and he said, you know, besides that, he said, I get up every day, and I work my butt off. He said, I work very, very hard. I'm disciplined. I have a regular way I go at things to get ready. And I think the lesson there is one for all of us. I mean, we all might have different skills than Tiger, but here's a guy who was obviously born with a great blessing as far as his capabilities. But he works them hard. He doesn't just let them happen to him. He works them hard to make himself better. And I think that's the lesson I take away from Tiger.
Rick Wagner, you've had some unbelievable experiences. Dinners at the White House. You've met so many people. Was there one or two meetings that you just pinched yourself and said, how did this ever happen?
Yeah, I mean, you're right, Jack. You look back and you go, oh, when I was a kid, I would never expect it to do one of these. And I think for any American, the chance, the first time you go to the White House under any circumstance, your heart's beating. You've been there. And you're going to meet the president. I mean, your heart's about to jump out of your chest. It's such a big thing. So obviously experiences like that are in my mind. But I think the first time I met a head of state that at least sticks in my mind was when I went down to Rungiam do Brasil, and I was invited up to meet the president. And so this was a big deal, and you go into his office, and knowing that we have to do this in Portuguese, not English, was also added a little to the excitement. But since then, you know, I've had a chance to meet lots of heads of state, you know, key leaders in governments and business. And it's really a privilege. And what you come away with is many of these people are more alike than different. I mean, they're driven, they're talented, and, you know, they're just trying to do the best job they can for their country or whatever.
Harry Truman used to have a sign on his desk, the buck stops here. You're in the corner office. Success has 1,000 fathers, failure is an orphan. Talk about being in that corner office.
It is a little bit of a different feeling, and I've seen and felt it myself in my own career. When you're part of the team and moving up in the organization, you do want to win, and you feel the pressures. But when you are the guy, you are the top person, sort of every success is credited to you, which isn't accurate, by the way, because just as you said, it's teamwork. But kind of every failure is yours too, and you have to be willing to take that on. And you have to actually, from the standpoint of running the organization, it's good to take responsibility when things aren't working well. I think it, you know, it sends the right message of you know, humility and teamwork. But it's not easy the first few times that comes your way.
I admire you for a lot of reasons. One is that you're willing to lose the battles as long as you win the war. For some of us, we can never lose a battle, therefore we never win the war. How did you learn to let go and lose battles?
Well, like you say, Jack, I don't think any of us, we never like to lose, particularly if you're a competitive sports guy like you and I are. You never like to lose anything, but I think you always have to be looking at the bigger picture. And so sometime, you know, you have to say, look, I'm going to put my resources on to solve this problem. And if the result of that is I don't do quite as well in this area, then I'm going to have to come back and get that later. But prioritization and focus is a big part of being able to win the war, as you say. And sometimes that means that some of the things that aren't as important along the way, you can't put the resources behind it. And I think that's a big part of being successful in business or in life, actually.
Rick Wagner, every company, team, school, family has a culture. What's General Motors' culture, and how have you propagated this culture worldwide?
Well, we try to build a culture that's what I call one company, where we think ourselves as one global team, General Motors, where we try to integrate our different functions. We try to build a culture where people can be candid with each other, a culture of success, where we have high expectations for each other, and we trust each other to achieve those high levels of success. And I think we try very hard to build a diverse culture at GM, because we do have a business that's global, and it's important that we benefit from the diverse perspectives that come from different nationalities, genders, races. We have a history of doing that. We can always do better, though.
Can you talk about the future of General Motors?
I think the future's exciting. In fact, I suspect there's not been an era for a long time with as much change in front of us. And I would put it in a couple of different areas. First of all, we've had a chance to restructure our company, so I think we can be more competitive in the U.S. going forward. I'm very excited about our future product direction and focus on design. But really, the two changes that are biggest are this change in the propulsion systems from our vehicles, from relying pretty much on petroleum to other sources of energy for the next, I'd say, over the next 10, 20 years. And then the growth in the so-called newer economies or emerging economies, places like China, India, Russia, These are exciting opportunities for our company, but also bring challenges. So as I look at the future, I think it's a bright one, and I think it's one that is going to provide us the chance to grow a lot, and I think actually be quite a bit more competitive maybe than we were for the prior 20 years.
Harvard welcomes you back, invites you back to give a couple-minute speech on globalization. What do you tell those young Rick Wagners at Harvard?
That's a very important question, because I think it's important that all of our young people recognize that the world is much smaller due to communications, due to the lowering of trade barriers. And it's really up to us, particularly the young people at Harvard that you have me talking to here, Jack, because they are going to be future leaders of business and government, and they need to have a perspective which embraces the opportunity of globalization, which means being open to other cultures, taking advantage of the best of each culture, and being able to work with people who grew up in different cultures. And I think that's the world that our kids are going to be in, that we're in right now, and our kids are going to be in more. And it's an exciting world, and one that does require that we really embrace the opportunities.
I read this recently. Question, what's the truest definition of globalization? Answer, Princess Diana's death. How come? Answer, an English princess with an Egyptian boyfriend crashes into a French tunnel, driving a German car with a Dutch engine, driven by a Belgian who was drunk on Scottish whiskey, followed closely by Italian paparazzi on Japanese motorcycles, treated by an American doctor using Brazilian medicines. This email was first sent by a Canadian using Bill Gates technology, and you are probably reading this on one of IBM's clones that used Taiwanese-made chips on Korean-made monitors assembled by Bangladeshi workers in a Singapore plant. Transported by lorries driven by Indians, hijacked by Indonesians, unloaded by Sicilian longshoremen, trucked by Mexican illegal aliens, and finally sold to you. That, my friend, is globalization. Amen. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm, presents Anything Is Possible with Jack Rasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Rick Wagner. Rick, this year, two great entities are celebrating 100th anniversaries. The first one is the Chicago Cubs, 100 years ago, won the World Series. And then, conversely, General Motors, its 100th year. What are your plans this year for GM and its anniversary?
Hopefully we'll win the World Series, Jack. I don't know. We've got a lot of celebrations. We're putting it under the headline of GM Next. So interestingly enough, we're going to spend some time looking back and invite people through websites and others, other ways to talk about their own relationship with GM, their history with their cars, their family that worked at GM, whatever. But we're going to spend most of our time looking forward, and we're going to engage people from all around the world to talk about the future of the automobile, what role could GM play in the future of the automobile, these sorts of things. So it should be not just really a celebration of our past, but also a celebration of the future of our industry and the role that we hope GM will play in it.
Can you talk about China?
Yeah, China's been an amazing story to watch, Jack. We went in China in an aggressive way back in about 1996. By the time we got up and running, maybe a year or two later, and with our joint venture partners, we operate there as a 50-50 joint venture. Last year, in 2007, we sold over 1 million units, which makes China now our second largest market in the world. It's been amazing for us to be part of that, and the most interesting thing is there's a huge amount of growth in front of us. So really been amazing to see in a short period of time how things could change there.
Rick Wagner, what's the biggest thing you've learned from the Chinese people?
I'd say the Chinese people have redefined how to think about growth. I mean, we used to be happy in the West if you grew at 3.5%, 4% a year per annum. I mean, as a nation, they've been growing in double digits, 10, 12% for almost two decades now. And so it set an energy, a pace, a standard of advancement that, you know, I think has gotten me thinking that, you know, it's possible to move fast and even move faster. And it's obviously going to have a big impact on the world as a whole, whether it's tremendous increase in the demand for energy and how does that affect the auto business, or the opportunity to sell more products there. So there's a lot of changes that the Chinese dynamism is driving. Not all good, but we have to react to them.
In life today, Rick, the only constant is change. We all love change when it's the other guy, not when it's us. How do you try to convince your people worldwide we've got to change every day?
Try to talk about the opportunities that change brings, because you are so right. If you resist change, that's a lot of negative energy fighting what is ultimately inevitable. And there are a lot of rewards if you can be part of and even get out in front of change. So we try to show examples of where we have been successful in changing, anticipating changes. And we really try to build a culture that celebrates our progress, but you wake up the next day thinking, how can I get better? And that is very, very much in the spirit of taking advantage of change as it occurs.
In business today, the bar keeps getting raised every quarter. It's the same thing is true in sports, etc. How do people thrive when that bar keeps getting raised over and over?
Yeah, it is a tough thing, because if you've achieved something great and you come in the next day and you've got to do something even greater, you've got to develop a system for getting yourself up for the next challenge. And I think it's back to maybe what I was mentioning before. Ultimately, you need to find a way to really celebrate the successes that people achieve, but at the same point, sort of have what I call a nervous feeling in your stomach. How can I make this better? And the amazing thing is, if you have that attitude about, gee, what could I do to make this better? It is remarkable the kind of improvements you can see. I go to assembly plants and see, we've been assembling cars for 100 years, right? And you talk to a guy on the line and he'll show you a kind of change he made which significantly improved productivity or quality. See, people have been doing this for 100 years. This guy thought of that, and it just shows me that the attitude of how can we get better is one that you need to have pervasive throughout all levels of your organization. And if you do, that's a real competitive advantage.
You're back at Harvard. You're talking to these young students. What would you say to them? Why should they consider a career in the U.S. auto industry today?
Yeah, I think that's an easy one. First of all, the products are unbelievable. You don't have to explain to anybody what you do if you tell them you work for a car company. They know exactly what you do. They may have some opinions about your design or your styling or whatever. It's an industry that's really an important industry for our economy. It generates a lot of jobs. It's high tech, kind of leading edge, new propulsion systems, for example. You get a chance to play globally, and you get into all the relevant issues of the day, the big economic policy, social policies that face the country. You really have a important role in those. So it's an industry to be in if you want to make a difference, and it's an industry where you can make a difference.
Let's go back to July of 2005. One of your toughest critics, Stephen Gursky, works for Morgan Stanley. He's on you all the time, okay? He's tougher on you than Rush Limbaugh is on Hillary. And what do? You go and you hire this guy. Why?
Well, Steve, I thought, was very and is a very smart guy, and he brought a perspective on our business that I thought would be interesting for us to have from the inside. As Steve was an industry analyst, though, we couldn't tell him everything that we knew. It was prohibited under various disclosure laws. So we hired him, and we knew it was going to be just for a couple years, as a sort of internal consultant, and said, okay, you've had all these great ideas. Here's what we're thinking about and why. What's your critique of them? What could we do better? And I very much enjoyed working with Steve for the couple years that he was with us, and I think he brought a very good perspective inside the company to help sort of, gee, outsiders see this, and now that I see what you're doing inside, I understand, but you still have to change this, do this better, explain it in a better way. So good example of working with a smart guy who has a different perspective, and I think both of us benefiting.
When you eventually step down, how would you like to be remembered?
I'd like to be remembered as part of the team that got General Motors back in the U.S. Mainstream, really the car company that everybody wants to buy a vehicle from, the company that's leading in the next generation propulsion systems, and a company that is far more global and is able to play around the world. And I think if we can do all that, it will have been a good run for me.
Rick Wagner, who are your heroes?
Well, I have had a lot of people that have influenced my life, but a guy like Mike Krzyzewski, my friend, the basketball coach at Duke, has had an enviable track record of success, and I think branched out well beyond just winning basketball games. A great example of a leader. I have great respect for Ronald Reagan, who's a man who had a vision and, frankly, didn't get into the details, sometimes criticized for it, but led the country to some very important and, I think, favorable changes. When I was a kid, I had a lot of sports heroes, guys you knew, like Dick Grode and Brooks Robinson and Jerry West. And I think the common thread would be people who were successful in their field and did it in a way that we could all admire.
I've always been amazed at Kathy Wagner. Talk about your wife and mate, Kathy Wagner.
Oh, well, Kathy's my most important partner in life. I had a privilege of meeting her when we were in college at Duke, and we married shortly thereafter, although her father later confessed he thought I would never propose. I didn't think it took that long. And then we've been together ever since. And if you look back, she's the reason why we took all these international moves, because she was ready to go more adventuresome than me. And she's been the person who's enabled me to really focus so much time on my job, because she's done a terrific job with all other aspects of our life. And now that our kids are finishing up at home and out on their own, it's a lot of fun to spend even more time just the two of us.
Last question. What advice would you give to our young listeners this evening?
I think my advice would be this. The world is an exciting place. There are so many opportunities out there. And I would encourage each child to get the best education that you can, find something that you enjoy, and go at it with passion and enthusiasm. In a way, things look so big that you think you can't have an influence, but every day I meet people who have taken on something with a passion, with an enthusiasm, been able to attract the right people to work with them, and have achieved some remarkable things. And so I'd never underestimate the difference that an individual can make if they go at life with a commitment, hard work, passion, and enthusiasm.
Rick Wagner, thanks for doing this. Thanks for the job you've done with General Motors, what you've done for this city, this state, and this whole country.
Thanks very much, Jack.
And the way you've done it as well. Our guest next Sunday will be the managing partner of UHY Advisors of Michigan, Gordon Vollmer. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible.